Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do a review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. So not a lot of news this time out, still cruising around the Pacific. I visited New Zealand and other places, uploaded a previous podcast a bit late, but hopefully it went through and people were enjoying that. I always tell people, hey, email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any feedback or anything that you want to say. And lots of people do email with book recommendations and other questions and things, and I do respond to every single one. However, there is another way to get a hold of me, and if you go to goodreads.com, if you want to speak not just to me, but to other listeners of the podcast, there's a goodreads.com listener, SFBRP listeners group, and you can sign up there, and there's discussions there as well. And the latest topic that someone has put up on the 27th of November by Alexander, it's a topic about Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom called Luke versus the Magic Kingdom. And it was like, it obviously started off as an email, but then it got too big. So we've got this sort of like, was it six or seven part brain fart thing. Some of my reactive brain farts by Alexander, with lots of images attached and lots of arguments about what I might have missed in the book and sort of topics that it brought up. Now, it's a lot of stuff there. I didn't respond to every point that Alexander brought up, but some other listeners have done. So if you want to read through and see what other people say about this novel and about the different things that that Sean, Jenny, me, Moldy Squid, Chris have all had our say on this topic, so you can check that out. I thought I'd just mention that there in case you want to sort of see some of the messages that come in and some of the feedback that I give. That's it for now. Let's get on to today's book that I'm going to be reviewing in this episode. It's called Destiny's Road by Larry Niven. And I've reviewed a few of his books before. I think all the books that I've done are the books that he's co-authored. Lots of people say, hey, you should read and review Ringworld. I think I've read Ringworld like twice before, and I don't think I need to read it again just to review it. It's a good book. Ringworld, good book. It's a classic for a reason. Lots of cool aliens, lots of interesting worlds, the characters go on an adventure and things like that. And that's sort of early Larry Niven work, or earlier Larry Niven work. This is Destiny's Road, was written in the 90s and released, it says here at the beginning, I turned in the draft of Destiny's Road in August 1996, 4 years overdue. I knew it was an ambitious project, and I flinched from it. This book, it says here, copyright 1997, first published 1997. By Tall Books, and it's a not very chunky book. I've got a hardcover. I was in a city in New Zealand, Dunedin, and I walked past a secondhand shop, and I always go into these secondhand shops everywhere that I go around the world. I love visiting secondhand shops, and I normally buy a book or take a photo at least or do something like that, and I picked up two books there. This was just $5 New Zealand, so I thought I'd give it a go. It's got an audiobook release on Audible. I think Audible Frontiers put it out, and it was mentioned on the recent SFF Audio Recent Arrivals and New Releases podcast that they do there. And they mentioned it, and they said, hey, you should check it out. It's an audiobook, Larry Niven. It's a young adult book. And I was like, is it? Because I remember reading this book maybe 10 years ago. I remember getting out from the library maybe when I was at university. I can't even remember. But quite a while ago, I got this book and read it, and I thought, well, I'll revisit it because I remember, you know, enjoying it enough, and I didn't remember very much about it except the sprinkles or sparkles or whatever they're called. So yeah, there it is. So let me get into it then. The world. Oh, let me just say how it was a chunky book. 350 something pages in the hard cover. So the world of this book, it's set in this. I actually made notes as I was going through this time because it was a paper book that I was reading, not an ebook, an audiobook. So I found it very easy to make notes. So the world is very simple. There's some 700 years in the future. People are living on a colony on a different planet than Earth called Destiny. The planet's called Destiny. So what happens is that Earth sent out various colonists to one place, and that colony failed. And then they sent out another set of colonists to another planet, and they learnt from what happened before. And the and the what was it called? The Argos was the starship that went across there. The Argos turned up, and they went down and landed people on the planet. Lots of people died on the trip over, but they managed to land about half of the colonists from the ship. And then the Argos suddenly disappears. It just goes, hey, we're out of here. We're not going to hang around in orbit around this world. We're going to go off and do our own thing. So the Argos disappeared, and they're left on this peninsula called the Crab Peninsula, out in the middle of this ocean, away from the rest of the continent. The idea being that if you land on a small peninsula, you'll be able to sort of like, there won't be that many big predators there. You'll be able to protect it. You'll be able to, whatever's going on, a peninsula is quite a bit, protected in some ways. And there was two, they have two fusion-powered landers. One is called the Cavorite and one is called the Columbiad. And what happens one day is that they go, well, we need to go and explore. We're going to have to seed life, Earth life around in this colony. So the Cavorite flies off. And as it flies away, the fusion flame underneath it burns a road in the land. And that's what's called Destiny's Road. It's the road which has been fused into the rock. The rock is fused into a road as the Cavorite flies away, and it starts in a spiral. You can see this by looking at the front cover of this of the novel. There's a spiral, and as the spiral gets bigger and bigger, it suddenly just strikes off at a tangent and keeps going. Now the people who live in this spiral road pattern, the original colonists, about 250 years after the Cavorite has gone. And it never came back, and nobody really knows what happens to it, but it's gone off down the road. And I just read a thing here. It says, on the front cover, it says, others are sure the Cavorite exploded or the crew was killed by undiscovered destiny creatures. No settler who has gone down the road has ever returned. So that's what we got. Like the technology in the Spiral Town is slowly failing. They've got some computers, but they're failing. They've got some different technology, like radios, and they're failing, and some tractors, and they're failing. So the technological level in the Spiral Town, the city of Spiral, Spiral Town is what it's called, keeps going down and down and down. But they are resupplied, not with technology, but with a thing called sprinkles by caravans, which keep coming back up the road. And of course, the big question is, okay, where are these caravans coming from, and where do they get the sprinkles? The sprinkles are the things which you have to eat, because the plants that you get on the local life that you eat, the local crops and the local seafood and things like that, doesn't have all the nutrients that you need to survive. Humans need to survive. So if you don't get sprinkles, you grow up kind of mentally retarded in some way, mentally disabled and physically disabled if you don't get any at all. So there's obviously some dietary thing. So they're going, okay, so where are the sprinkles from? Nobody knows. And it says this, for Jemmy Blucher, a young farm boy, the questions burn too hot. He yearns to leave the mind-numbing work of his father's field and follow the road. The course of Jemmy's life is decided for him when he accidentally kills a caravan worker in a tavern fight. So that's a bit of a weird thing plot-wise, is that you think, oh, this is going to be a quest. Jemmy is going to go off down this road. Jemmy is our protagonist, of course. He's going to go head off down this road. And you think that it's this burning passion for him to see what is down at the far. It's his obsession in his life. What is down the road? What is down the road? But we can't go down there. It's too dangerous. But the caravans come down there. Where did the caravans come down? Where did the Cavorite go? And all these different questions. And you think that's the main thing that's going to set him off. But actually, it's not. Because like it says here, he kills a caravan worker and then goes, well, that's it. I've got to then escape from the justice. I've got to escape from the town. But it's a bit weird that he's like, oh, I've got to escape from the town, but instead of escaping in the opposite direction of the caravans, I'm going to go in the way that the caravans go and just go down the road. So it's this weird beginning to this story, the weird plot. It's like, okay, is he leaving because he's so curious, or is he leaving because he's got no choice, and because then because he doesn't want to be caught for killing this guy in this tavern fight, accidentally killing him, but not really accidentally killing him, not quite sure if it was murder, if he just wanted to see what happened. It's a bit of a weird thing. So that we get. So then what we have is got this. The rest of the world is relayed to us through what Jemmy finds along the way. He gets to another town, and they're like, oh, what's this town? Oh, I don't know what's going on here. And then he meets these other people, and then he meets a caravan, and then he goes with the, you know, this other thing, and then he goes here and goes there, and he just makes his way further down the road. I don't want to give too many spoilers about what he finds and all the answers that he finds there, but of course he does find out where the sprinkles come from. He does find out what happened to the caveret, and he works out why Spiral Town is kind of isolated down at the end of this road, and everyone is kept, you know, and why it is a mystery. When anyone could just go off down the road, why don't people just go off down the road? And why is he one of the only people to leave? And of course there's that thing, nobody who ever leaves down the Spiral Road, down Destiny's Road, ever returns to Spiral Town. And of course it goes in a full circle, very satisfying end to this story, end to the plot, when he gets back and he has all the answers, and he makes a difference, or he wants to make a difference in Spiral Town when he gets down to back at the end of it. But along the way, the plot is a little bit weird. It's kind of all over the place. It starts off and Jemmy is 6 years old or 10 years old or whatever it is, and then it skips forward until he's like 18, 19 years old, and then he turns up somewhere and he stays there for a few months, and the narrative skips forward, and then at one point it goes, you know, it's lots and lots of details about these individual little stories along the way, and then suddenly it'll skip forward 20 years and you're like, whoa, skipping forward 20 years and he still hasn't got the answers. The plot, there's some good ideas along the plot, but the timing is all off. And not just in the pacing as well. I'm thinking the timing. Now, this is what I, you know, as I was reading through, I was like, well, how long does it take to get down a certain distance of this road? Because in sometimes it feels as though it's taking him months and months to get down the road. Say when he's traveling with a caravan and he's learning how to cook, it seems like the skills that he gets when he's learning how to cook, it obviously takes months and months and months. But then he gets back and you're like, wait a second, the years on Destiny are shorter. But then he gets back and all of this has happened in the time that he's been away. But then in another time, he gets down the road like on a bicycle, like really quickly. And I think what this book would have benefited from is just to have everything spread out a lot more, like have the road a lot longer. It's almost disappointing how short the road is. Well, not, I don't want to say how short the road is, because it's full of stuff. The world building is very good, and I really do like the alien life, and I like the way the political setup is, and all these other things, and all these questions that I don't want to spoil and don't want to get into, because that's what this book is about. It's like a mystery. What is he going to find down this road? And those answers are, I think, very good answers and very interesting answers, and I like the whole world, and I like the setup, I like the aliens, I like the all the different things that go on along it, but the individual plotting and the timing and stuff, it seems a little bit weak, and it's a bit confusing, because at one point he goes away and then comes back, and I'm like, wait a second, how can all of that have happened when the next time he goes down a different stretch of road, it's the same stretch of road, he does it in a day, and then when he comes in, sometimes he gets back and someone's had a kid, like, what's going on here? And then the skipping forward, it's a bit strange. You know, when we do get the final revelation, the world that has been created is more interesting than the story at parts of the story of Jemmy discovering it. Like, at some points, it's just like, well, what is the secret? And then he just asks someone and they just tell him. Or he asks a computer program and it just tells him and things like that. And it's like, well, why didn't he just ask a bit earlier? Why did he have to wait all this time and stuff? So it's a weird thing that, he leaves. Is he really curious to find out the different secrets, or is he not? Or is he just wanting to settle down and have a good life with a new girlfriend, or is he not, and stuff? So, and there's other plot holes, like, for example, at some point he's going and people don't recognise him, you know. This person, he spends months and months with them and meets them later on, and they don't recognise him because the light is different or something, or this situation is different and they're not expecting him to see him there, because he's a fugitive for, like, the vast majority of this book, and he doesn't want to be recognised. And then at some point, someone just recognises him immediately, and it's like, oh, and then his family doesn't recognise him, and then this other person who is close to his family doesn't recognise him, and this other person just does recognise him. So there's a bit of inconsistency with timing and inconsistency with the idea that someone can become a fugitive and just pass as a random guy and stuff, when sometimes he's recognized and sometimes he's not. But like I say, when you do get to the end, I did find the end satisfying, although along the way, the plots, the little plots and the little diversions and the little stories along the way are sometimes a bit silly and sometimes don't have a lot of logic, whereas the entire world does have logic, kind of. So the characters that we get here, what people say about Larry Niven is that he does really good aliens and stuff like this, and then but his human characters aren't so great. And that's what we get here a bit. We don't really get great insight into Jemmy as a person. I mean, it's a coming of age thing. He's growing up and learning to become a man along the way, which is an okay story. But it's very kind of surface level, or we only get the surface level. All of the stuff that he does along the way, sometimes he's meant to be clever and sometimes he's meant to be silly. I actually quite like that part where if he doesn't get the sprinkles, his mental capacity diminishes. And I thought that was really... really quite interesting when he's going, oh, what's going on here? I just don't understand. What's going on here? I don't understand. Why is this happening? Why is it? And as the humans reading this book, as the normal humans, like without any kind of restriction on their intellect, we're going, well, of course it's this, and of course it's that, and what's this? But then when he gets his intellect back again, he doesn't ruminate over, oh, and when I was there, oh, that was obviously the answer. He just moves on, and we as readers had just got to, like, come to the same conclusions as Jemmy has. And this happens time and time again. He'll suddenly reach a conclusion, but then not explain it to us as the reader. And we're just left to catch up, which I actually quite like, because then we can see his mind process, but by the results of his thought process and the way that his mind works, rather than always it being explained to us point by point. So Jemmy is a weird character. Also, he changes his name a lot, because when he sets out, he's Jemmy, and then he becomes Tim something, and then he becomes Tim something else, and then he becomes Jeremy, and then he changes his name again, and he's Jeremy this and Jeremy that. So all the time changing his name throughout, which it isn't confusing, because I actually quite liked it. I just go, okay, this is obviously the main character, we're following his story, so when he suddenly turns up with a totally different name, I'm just like, well, this is it, no problem at all. However, we meet lots of other people along the way, because he's constantly moving on. He sticks with a group for maybe a chapter or two chapters, and there may be five or six people in that group, and we learn all their names, and we have this name, and we have that name, and this one, and that one, and then he moves on, and then we've got a whole other raft of names, and then when characters turn up later on, it's only if their name is, like, quite recognizable, but then because he's working with wagons of families, different families work on this wagon in the caravan, and other people do there, and he talks to lots of people's relatives, so you can't even rely on the second name, like the surname, the family name of the people to work out who is who, because meeting different family members, and then to meet someone in, oh, is that the person's sister? Oh no, it's not the sister, it's the mother-in-law. Oh no, it's not the mother-in-law, it's the stepmother-in-law, and lots of different confusing stuff there. And so each time I was reading, I was thinking, oh, who's this again? Ah, yes. Oh, did he have sex with this person? Yes, of course he had sex with them. Oh, that's another thing. There's lots of sex in this book. We don't read the sex. There's nothing graphic about it. But in the same way that Larry Niven in Ringworld brings in the idea, in the Ringworld novels, he brings in the idea of sex as some kind of social currency, that or some kind of social bonding mechanism, that when different alien species get together on Ringworld, they all have sex with each other, and it makes everyone, you know, make love, not war. And but because they're different species, they don't need to worry about any kind of sexually transmitted diseases, or maybe they do, I'm not sure if it's talked about, but they don't need to worry about interbreeding, because it's not going to happen between the different species. In this novel, we do have a lot of sex, because the caravan, one reason why the caravans go up and down the road is to make sure the gene pool stays vibrant. No, what would be the word? Mixed. I don't know. Vibrant is the wrong word. What? Diverse. Diverse gene pool. Deep gene pool rather than shallow gene pool. And that's one of the reasons why the caravans exist, like I say, because there's so few people landed on the planet in the first place, and then half of them died on the way, and then another half of them got discarded, and then at the beginning of the colony, half of them left, you know, so we get down to this smaller and smaller gene pool, and so we do have a lot of ideas about, you know, okay, a good way to get around this is just for lots of people to have sex with each other, and it'll be part of the social conventions of life on the road, which could be interesting, but it almost becomes comical how often Jemmy just managed to have sex with people. And then even when he gets into like a social unit where people do have not monogamous relationships, but they're meant to be family units, and then it's like, well, it doesn't matter, I'll just go and have sex. And I'm just thinking, I think Larry Niven, he seems to I'm not sure. Maybe he just seems to like have a weird idea that, hey, these people are just going to be happy to have sex with anyone. They're just going to like that. And jealousy won't be a problem. And this won't be a problem. And that won't be a problem. And I do think that for some people, maybe who live in California and took lots of drugs in the 60s, having sex with random people is just part of the way of life. I mean, that's just what you want to do. You want to just go out and have sex with random people. It's just part of it. But I know that I don't think I could be in a relationship where that happens. In fact, I've tried to be in a relationship that where that happened. My psycho ex-girlfriend, one reason she was a psycho ex-girlfriend was she was a total nymphomaniac. Now, sex with a total nymphomaniac is awesome, but here's the rule, guys. Don't put your dick in crazy, because other people are also putting the dick in crazy. And it makes it very difficult to have a relationship with someone when you know that when they're not having sex with you and you're apart for a week, that in that meantime, they're going to have sex with other people. Now, again, it sounds a bit stupid me just laying this out here, but I was in a relationship like that and it's just terrible. You can't have relationships where people are just, oh, I'm just going over and random sex over here. It doesn't work for me. And I think I'm kind of, in many ways, I'm not representative of normal humanity, but in many ways I am. Everyone is unique. In some way, but a lot of people are sort of like baseline human, have baseline kind of like, I'm just a normal heterosexual guy. And I, when I'm in a relationship, hey, I'm just going to be in a relationship and I want to be in a relationship with one person. And I'm very happy with that. And I don't think that if there was sex just on tap in other places that I would, well, sometimes work on cruise ship sex is on tap in other places. And some people do have random sex with as many people as they want or as many people as possible and things like that. I've met the crazy people, but I don't put the dick in the crazy people because they're crazy people. And it seems like this Larry Niven wants to think that in the future we're all going to be the crazy people. But I think, you know, humanity is going to say, no, we're not going to put the dick in the crazy people. Or anyway, it's a bit weird. I don't know what I'm trying to say there, but it's a bit strange. In science fiction, you'd think that the science fiction has to comment on the human condition for it to be interesting. And when it doesn't, when it's just about technological ideas, that's okay. Whereas here, I think he's using like one of the most fundamental things about sex or the human condition, which is the sex drive and about loving relationships and kind of just, he screws with them in a way. There's a bit of a spoiler at the end. You can kind of see it coming, but something happens. And then Jemmy just has sex with, I'm not going to spoil it, but he has sex with someone else so quickly that you're just thinking, wait a second, I can't identify with you as a human because your human reaction to this is like a 14-year-old boy who hasn't developed in any way, and you're meant to be an old man at this point, or an older man, you know, 50-year-old something man. And yes, that's very strange. Where is the human? Yeah, what was I going to say? Yeah, Jemmy has drive kind of things, but he doesn't really have anything else. And then everybody else, all these other characters, it seems that too many people are happy to be ignorant. Now, I wasn't quite sure if this was a clever thing or a bad writing thing. So many times people will, things will happen in a novel and there'll be a mystery. And the only reason there's a mystery is because people aren't curious enough to find out. And the only reason why the main, like the protagonist, doesn't know something is because he just hasn't bothered asking somebody. And the reason why some conflict comes up is just because he hasn't bothered talking to somebody. And that's the main driving factor of it. And it's a bit weird that you think, well, why is nobody else in Spiral Town? Why is nobody else curious? And why is it when Jemmy leaves, he's sort of curious, half curious, and then he just loses curiosity? And there is, if I'm being kind in this book, there is a really good reason why the people in Spiral Town think that way. And it's actually very clever. And I thought, oh, that's very good. But then there's a lot of other people throughout the rest of the book. And it's like, well, why are these people the same as the Spiral Town people? They don't have the same very clever and interesting plot point, which puts them into that situation. And yet sometimes they have the same lack of curiosity and lack of drive and lack of sort of like, get up and go oomph kind of stuff to make them see the rest of the world in the way that they should, or get out there and do more stuff, onto the peninsula or cross back from the peninsula, all that kind of stuff. It's a bit strange and I wanted a bit more of that. Like I say, half of the people in the novel, their lack of curiosity is answered about, but the other half is a bit lacking. So what do we have here? Talk about the science fiction ideas. Yeah, I really like this. The replicators, when they talk about them, that's very clever. The different levels of technology, as you go down the road, the technology levels increase and decrease. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but I really like that idea. And the whole, one of the main thematic things about this is the idea of it being a hydraulic empire. And you sort of pick this up straight away as soon as you work out who really holds the power. And I'm talking, how many chapters? There's three parts. Let's say 350 pages. You work out, or what, maybe page 30 or something, that the people who really have power, the real people are the merchants, are the wagon caravans that come down in and out. And I realized right away that it's some kind of hydraulic empire. And the idea of a hydraulic empire is being, if you control the water source, and there's not enough water to go around and people are unhappy, you divert the water. This is the example even given in the book here. You divert the water from one village who doesn't like you to the village that does like you, and the village that does like you likes you even more and will support you in coming wars and political struggles and things like that because you provided them water. And the ones who don't like you, well, they don't have any water and they all die out. So the controlling populations by access to water, or controlling the water as a means of controlling the populations, is a good one. And I could kind of see that happening at the beginning. It's more complex than that, but I really like that idea that it's a novel written about that situation and one person trying to kind of personally break out of the controls of this hydraulic empire, in this case by sprinkles, which they need to supplement to supplement all the minerals and things that they need to get by. So that's a good one as well. I like the whole story of the backstory, which gets shared a lot here with the spaceship that comes across and the different landers that land and things like that. It reminds me, this book, when I read it years ago, is probably a bit of an influence on one of the novels that I've written twice already, and I'll write a third version called The Monster Story Conference, which you can read on my website for free there. I'm obviously sort of like picking out different aspects. I always really like the, hey, colonists land on a world, something goes wrong, what happens later kind of story. And I always want to work out why the colony fails when if you can fly from Earth to another solar system and land, your level of technology must be pretty high, and you must be able to deal with anything that comes in. So how can the colony fail? It's a bit weird where, you know, you when you're going across to, well, I'm down in New Zealand and things like that, and you talk about these colonists who come down here and that they could sail all the way around the world, that they could sail from, say, that I just went to Akaroa in New Zealand, and there were some French colonists who come down here. They'd bought the land off the local Maoris, and they said, oh, we're going to come down here. And when they come down here, because they could sail from France to New Zealand, exactly halfway around the world, that they had the technological capability to do that means that when they turned up, they had the technological capability by that point that the colony wouldn't fail. Whereas just sailing across the Atlantic, that's a short enough gap that colonies could get across the Atlantic and then fail there. But if you're coming all the way down to New Zealand, by the time you can easily just get on a boat and know that you're going to arrive in New Zealand or in Australia, the colonies got down there and didn't fail. Whereas, say, the mutiny of the Bounty, on the Bounty with, you know, Christian Fletcher and stuff turning up there, you know, it was really, really hard work for them to get around the world. They couldn't go around Cape Horn. They wanted to go around Cape Horn to get to Tahiti, but they didn't manage to do it, and they had to go the other way, and it was a real struggle at that point to get there. And, you know, it was probably going to fail, and most of the ships that went around the world at that point, you know, a lot of them didn't come back and things. So, you know, it's all around about the same time, but the different technological boundaries and hurdles to get over is sort of like a barrier to entry to these distant things. So anyway, what was I talking about? Thematically science. Oh no, that's what I'm saying. Yes, if you can get to another colony, why would your colony fail? Where is the drama? Why wouldn't it immediately be successful? And I like the ideas that he brings up in this novel. Is it about the diet? Is it about this? Is it about that? Is it about this? So that's I like those early colony kind of stories, especially if there's monsters, or if there's more than monsters, but monsters are good too. Writing. pretty basic writing. A lot of it is like dialogue, which is very quick dialogue. And if you're not following along, you're just going to go, what happened there? And a lot of the story is very brisk. And I really like that, because this book could have been an extra 100 or 200 pages longer if he went into details about the characters. But sometimes it is a bit too brisk. The writing is pretty basic, and I understand why someone would say that this is a young adult novel. Even though sex is quite a big part of it, there isn't a lot of the graphic sex, like I say. But then there is this thing, and there's these people who there's this idea of bird fucking, which I'm not going to go into now, but there's this expression, is like, no bird fucking allowed, no bird fucking, and it's just constantly fucking this, no bird fucking, fucking this, bird fucker. And I'm like, if this is a young adult novel, why this gratuitous bird fucking going all the time? Why just constantly talk about bird fucking? It's only in the very end part of the book. But then I realized at the beginning, so check this out. Oh, I just looked at the beginning of the book as well. It's got the dramatis personae, and it lists all the people. Oh, yeah, just at the wind farm. Andrew Bader, Shimon, being like this, and the surf rider, Howard, Karen, Jeremy, Judy, Eileen, Brenda. Wow, there's a lot of characters in this book. Anyway, so where was I thinking here? Yeah, I turned in this in the draft of Destiny's Road in August 1996, 4 years overdue. And it's dedicated to Marilyn, my wife, who reminded me of overdue contracts from time to time. Down here is like Michael Whelan, who displayed this magnificent cover painting in the Chicago Worldcon 5 years ago. And he's waited no patience at all. Our landscapes no longer quite match. So he's talking about the cover of the book in this dedication here at the beginning. And it, obviously this book, it feels like he had this idea and you think, wow, this is going to be an epic story. And it could have even been two books. I mean, there would have been enough in here to have like a whole series, but he does cram a lot of it in. But I think it was rushed at the end because, like I said, at one point, he just suddenly skips 20 years into the future. It's like, I can see that he wrote up until that point and he got all the information across. All the information that you need to work out the mysteries in this book are there. But then he had this way of wrapping up not just the mystery, but the personal journey of Jemmy and the plot itself, and it was going to take more time. And it's just like, I'll just skip forward in part three or something. I'll just skip forward 28 years. Or is it part three? And it's like 28 years later. And you're like, that's a bit unsatisfying. And I think that 28 years later was just sort of almost, you're going to go, well, that could have been a whole other book at the end there, but I'm going to just tack it on at the end. And there's lots of editing errors. Like I say, I think if you'd gone back through and you'd have worked out some of those time things, at some point it says they leave Spiral Town. And I'm like, they're not in Spiral Town. And I'm like, you just got the name of the town that we're in mixed up. And there's a few other things there as well. And there's other cultural references in here. One that I picked out is sort of like, these animals like they're built like armored Volkswagens. And I'm thinking, okay, a Volkswagen. A VW Beetle is obviously what they're describing here, but an armored VW Beetle. This book is set in, 2730 AD. But when the colonists landed and they described these things for the first time. Oh, yeah, at the beginning of all the chapter headings, we get these little excerpts from reports of the first landers, which is quite fun. So we get different hints of technological from a more technologically advanced kind of time at the beginning of each chapter, which is good. Anyway, but it says that that's 250 years in the past. So what we're talking about here, 2480 years AD. So let's just say, 500 years AD. Are they still going to be using the Volkswagen Beetle as a design reference, as a reference of everyday life? So again, it makes me think, he had this idea for a story, and then 5 years later, when he finally got round to finishing the story, he'd changed the time, and it wasn't set, you know, and the colonists didn't head out in, you know, as in 1990 or 2010. They didn't head out in 2010 and arrive there 50 years later, because then you could still say, the VW Beetle, that'd still be a cultural icon, and you'd still talk about it because, you know, the new Beetle's coming out now, so you can still talk about VWs. But I'm thinking, well, the culture that we're told that the colonists set off from in 2500 AD is very different. They're not going to be referencing VW Beetle. So again, I think that's just sort of like a sloppy missing of the editing process. And what's this other note here? Oh yeah, and if it's not young adult, so if it is young adult, why all the sex and why the word bird fucking? But if it's not young adult, I'd rather, I want it to have a little bit more complexity in, say, the characterization, and a little bit less complexity in the plot. Like, it's a bit like, oh, and then we do this, and then we do that, and then we do this. And the plot being driven forward is one thing. Oh, yeah, this is what I wanted to say. That's what I wanted to bring up, and now I remember. Why I wanted to bring up the Luke versus the Magic Kingdom discussion on the SFBRP listeners group on goodreads.com is that people there are talking about plot and over reliance on plot. Now, this book is very kind of plot heavy, that it, like, the revelations as they go through is based very much on sort of like, oh, at this point the character knows this, and at this point the character knows this, and the character really needs to go through this kind of experience to get the answers, and nobody else has these answers, but he manages to get them because of this point. So there's no point in this novel where at the end you go back and say, oh, well, we shouldn't have had that adventure. That adventure added nothing. All the way through, all of the little adventures that he goes on and all the events and the little stories that happen along the way, they all have a point, and it's all tied together nicely, even a bit too nicely, a little bit too easily at the end. But as you're going through, you're like, well, this is a bit twee. It's a little bit young adult-y in a way, a little bit basic, but, you know. But then some of the complexity, you think, well, okay, a young adult audience would love this. I mean, I must have been like 20 when I read this book. I think I was at university when I read it. I can't remember. But then you're thinking, well, in some ways, it's just unbalanced. So what else have I got in my notes here? Yeah, normally at the end of my review, I talk about the themes. Oh, just in case, just to bring it back to this SFBRP listeners group Goodreads discussion, people are saying, you know, does, you know, plot versus story, and then talking about what's this other one as well, what's the main thing that comes up here as well, literary fiction compared to genre fiction and mainstream literary fiction compared to all that kind of stuff. And I would talk about that kind of stuff, but I really don't care in a way. If I enjoy a book and it talks to me on a lot of levels, I could say, oh, that's a very literary book. Like, and they bring up the Wind-Up Girl. And I really like the Wind-Up Girl, but I don't consider... I mean, it is literary, you know, and things like that. But I find maybe Alistair Reynolds, one of his books, very literary and very satisfying on a thematic level. And that, when I read it and I think about it, I say, oh, I can pick out lots more about this. I can pick out loads more about this. And if I get that from a book, and I can get it from a fiction book, I can get it from, I mean, like a literary fiction book, I can get it from a science fiction book. Sometimes it happens with fantasy novels, not quite as much as it does with science fiction, I must admit, but it's there, you know. And that's why they say, you know, The Lord of the Rings makes a list of the greatest books of all time, because it talks about ideas and things. And then you usually, this is Sean talking here, you usually identify these literary authors and these literary readers as people by their insistence that 1984 can't be science fiction because it's good. And 1984 for me is, I think I rated it 4.9 or something like that. These books which do something new, which create a new insight into human condition and society and all these kind of things, and they really bring it full circle, and it's a really interesting story, and it's interesting and compelling characters. Once I get all of that, that's what I really love about a book. Now, Destiny's Road is not literary in any way. It's like almost the epitome of genre fiction, because it's so much about the ideas and so little about, you know, the characters, and it's so much about the plotting. But I can enjoy that book. The thing is, I don't think this book is great. It's an okay book. But on a deeper level, once I go, okay, the book is about, say, I mean, the deepest thing that I can bring out about this book is like, okay, well, people have sex a lot. But then there's like a scientific reason why people have sex a lot, rather than getting into the human condition. The human condition is kind of discarded. Oh, and why are these people here? Well, there's like this scientific kind of reason, or this, you know, political reason. I'm going to talk about, you know, a hydraulic empire. And then this reason, it always comes back, this book always comes back to the technical side of things. The technical part, the technical reason, the scientific reason, and seems to miss out, like, say, this human condition, and miss out on the deeper themes. And so when I get to this part of the book and I think, well, what are the themes of this book? It seems like it's a book written almost to illustrate that, hey, we don't need to do a thematic exploration that will connect with you on an emotional level. I'll just do it on a scientific kind of alien kind of technological level, and that'll be good enough. And in this book, it kind of is good enough. But there's nothing that I can talk about this book thematically which you won't get 100% by reading the book. Which is a real pity, because now I finished the book, and I actually said when I... I don't think I'll remember much about it. And I said that in my goodreads.com, if you go there and you follow my reviews, and if you follow me as a, you know, you can see my reading progress. I always make little comments about a book as I go through, and I was like, oh, starting this book, I've read it before, I don't remember much about it, all I remember is the sprinkles. And of course, by the end of it, the sprinkles are the most important thing, and they are the key to the Hydraulic Empire, and everything, all of the story, and all of the plot, and all of the world, and the whole of society, all comes back to the sprinkles. And even though it's just sort of, they're just mentioned as sort of like some kind of dietary supplement at the beginning for the people in Spiral Town, it becomes a lot more than that. And I realize that at the end of the book, yes, this is a book about sprinkles and their place in it. You know, you pick it up quite early on, and it's an investigation of that, but it's like on a technical basis. And by the end of it, I'm thinking, well, if when I pick this book up in 10 years' time and I'll read it again and think, well, why don't I remember that much about it? All I remember is the sprinkles. I'm not going to remember any of the characters, I know that. I'm not going to remember Jemmy or Tim or Jeremy or whatever his name is, who changes and does all this story. He's not a very compelling character. And as I said, the thematic exploration is so surface level, but it's done in a good way. So in the end, I'm going to award this book 3 stars because I did enjoy it. I read the whole thing in about a day and a half, well, in under 2 days, mainly because I was sitting around and didn't have very much to do on a cruise ship, and I had a bit of writer's block getting onto the last 3 chapters of my NaNoWriMo novel, which is very much a novella, about 30,000 words. I haven't finished that. I've got like 2 more chapters to read, to write, sorry. But I was reading this book and I got through it very quickly. It's quite enjoyable. It's fast paced. But I do understand that if you read this book and are totally dissatisfied with it and think, where's all complex? Where's the story? Where's the character and all that kind of stuff? It's like, well, that's not what the book is about. So I'll give it like 2.5 stars as being totally average, or maybe 3 stars. Did I say 3 stars? I'm thinking 2.5 stars because it's not that good. It's not bad, but that's what 2.5 stars. Like, 2.5 stars out of 5 means exactly halfway. It does what it does very well, needs more editing. But this is like, I think this is one of the first printing. This is like the hardcover. Maybe in later versions, they sort of like picked up on some of these mistakes, could do with like another edit. So maybe that's been done. But it's really nothing remarkable except for some of the ideas. But anyway, it's a quick read. Maybe it's a fun listen. Maybe it'll work better as an audiobook. I'm not sure. Give it 2.5 stars there. So, that's it from me for this book. Let me quickly pop across to goodreads.com and see what other listeners think of this. My review, I got 3 stars here, but it's 2.5 stars. 6 friends have reviewed it. Lawrence, 2 stars. Chris, 4 stars. Dan, 4 stars. Chris, 1 star. Ken, 2 stars. And David, 3 stars. So, you know, 2.5 stars, 2.67 average on here, and 3.26 average by generalgoodreads.com. Reviewers. So yeah, that's kind of, like I say, a very mid-level book there. Not a lot to say about this. So if you want to know what I'm reading next, let me just find. Oh, I've lost my other book. I bought another book from. One second. Let me find. Yeah. So I bought another book, and it's called Engines of Light, Book 2, Dark Light, by Ken MacLeod. It only cost $5, which is like, what, €3 or something like that. So I thought I'd buy it anyway, because I think this is the follow-up book to... Oh, yes, it is. So it's The Cosmonaut's Keep. It's the... and I read Cosmonaut Keep by Ken MacLeod a few years ago, and I thought I'd look out for this second one here. So here it is. I don't actually remember too much about Cosmonaut Keep, except there was dinosaurs and a failed colony, which suits me pretty well. And so I'll read this one, Dark Light, Chemicard. I'll read that probably on the flight back. I'm listening to Children of the Sky by Verna Vinge, and on my ebook reader I've tried to start it, but I keep reading and falling asleep in the evening. On Basilisk Station by David Weber, which is the first of the Honor Harrington series, which loads of people talk to me about, and I realised, oh, you can just download it from the Bain Free Library as an ebook. So I downloaded that a few weeks ago, and we'll get round to it soon as well. So that's it for me. Email me, luke@juggler.net. Check me out on goodreads.com. I've been referencing goodreads.com quite a bit in this because of the different reviews and discussions going on there, so you can join in there. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter, or you can even become my friend on Facebook, although most of the stuff I post on Facebook has got nothing to do with science fiction. It's more to do with my life and my juggling and keeping up with friends and things like that. Finally, you can check out my website, lukeburge.com/blog, for lots of different stuff on there and my fiction you can find here. And also, again, if you want to read my latest writing, which is called Get That Rat Off My Face. Get That Rat Off My Face is a short, weird kind of psychological thing, bit like a Philip K. Dick novel in a way. If you want to read it, I'm like two chapters away from finishing it, so I'm looking for some first readers who are willing to give some feedback and pick out different stuff. And then I want to release it as an ebook and as an audiobook, so hold on out if you want to have an audiobook version of that. Hopefully I'll get an audiobook recorded, version of it recorded in a few months' time. We'll see how that goes. Anyway, that's it for now. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.